Hi, I'm Doug Gordon, and this is Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hayao Miyazaki is one of the world's greatest living animators and an internationally acclaimed filmmaker. He's also the co-founder and head of Studio Ghibli. The Japanese animation studio is responsible for several acclaimed films that include the Academy Award-winning Spirited Away, as well as Princess Mononoke and Howl's Moving Castle. Miyazaki's cinematic story worlds are rich and dense universes featuring memorable characters, stunning animation, and touching stories. Susan Napier knows all about Miyazaki's life and film. She's the Goldthwaite Professor of Rhetoric and Japanese Studies at Tufts University. She's also the author of Miyazaki World, A Life in Art. Beta's own Steve Gotcher is a big fan of Miyazaki's films, so he video chatted with Susan to find out more about the legendary director and how she first learned of him.
I first saw a Miyazaki film in 1990, Nausicaä of the Valley of the Wind, which is from 1984. It's one of Miyazaki's earliest films.
Nausicaä, what are you doing here? This chamber is filled with toxic plants.
I collected the spores and grew them down here myself. Don't worry, the plants aren't poisonous.
They're not poisonous? It's true, the air is pure in here. But I know these plants from the jungle. These are some of the most lethal.
And it still holds up. It is an extraordinary, beautiful film. The imagery is remarkable. And this is a young director. Miyazaki was in his 40s. It was only his second feature-length film. And at the same time, it has its youth and vibrancy, but it's also remarkably sophisticated in its imagery, its narrative, its music. He started working at that time with a composer named Joe Hisaishi, who has been with him ever since. And the characters are just, frankly, even now, and I was telling my students this yesterday, they are still really more complex, more interesting, deeper than most characters you will see even now in a Hollywood movie. And then again, I just have to stress, this is 1984. It has a very strong, very interesting female protagonist. And I just had never seen anything like it before.
So you say that the young female protagonist, Nausicaä, is Miyazaki's alter ego. What makes you say that?
Over the 8 years I researched the book, and over the 10 or more years before that I had started getting interested in Miyazaki's films, because right from Nausicaä on, I began to think, this is a guy I want to know more about. I feel like I got to know Miyazaki a bit as a person. I mean, I met him several times. I also read a lot of his interviews, his own writings, and learned something about his history, his family, his own childhood. And Miyazaki, I actually was going to call the book The Last Utopian, because Miyazaki is a utopianist, which all that implies for good or ill. Utopianists are people who want the world to be a better place. However, the downside of being a utopian is that you get very frustrated when the world doesn't change the way you would like it to change. And so there's a lot of passion in being a utopian, a lot of desires that are not always fulfilled. And in Nausicaä, I think Miyazaki really created a person who is passionate and full of desires to change the world and ameliorate it, but can get frustrated. And we see Nausicaä changing. And I think that's why she embodies so much of Miyazaki's own ego, because she is fascinated by everything. Also, she's a scientist. She's a good swordswoman. She has a laboratory down at the bottom of her castle where she works to find ways to help the post-apocalyptic wasteland revive. And that's all great. And that's very much what I think of as Miyazaki, someone who's really trying to help things. But Nausicaä gets angrier and more frustrated. Sometimes people will tell me about the book. They say, well, we thought Miyazaki was just this, kind, cuddly person and, kind, cuddly, feel-good movies. And they are movies that make you feel good, I believe, or even sometimes transcendent, because they do speak of joy and hope, absolutely. But also, they do deal with the challenges and dark sides of living in the world that we're in.
One of the hallmarks of Miyazaki's films is that many of his protagonists are strong, complicated female characters. I was thinking of Sophie in Howl's Moving Castle, where she's turned into an old woman from a young woman, and she's immediately completely taken aback by the whole thing, but she adapts to it so quickly and accepts it and then moves forward from there. And I thought that was an amazing transition for a character who then basically leads the way through the rest of the film. You think that Howl is the main character, but no, it's actually Sophie who makes the changes.
Sophie! Sophie, help him, please! Sophie, do something!
Such drama.
Is he dead?
No, he's fine. He's just throwing a tantrum. Come on, give me a hand.
I agree with you completely, and that is one of the lovely things about the film. Yeah, it's called Howl's Moving Castle, and Howl is very much there, and he's cute and fun and you know, interesting. Yeah. But Sophie is tough. I really think it's kind of interesting because Miyazaki is showing the power that old age can have, especially being an old woman, because you are no longer seen as a sexual object. And Sophie knows she's not being seen as a sexual object, so she becomes liberated and is able to really become herself and, you know, start sort of thinking what she wants to think and doing what she wants to do and not worrying about the male gaze, because the male gaze isn't there anymore. And it's really a wonderful story about, very paradoxically, because you always hear about women worrying about aging, but here's a woman who has aged and become liberated and has released herself in a very fresh way.
Now, Miyazaki was born in 1941, and as you say in the book, his grandfather and his father and his uncle profited from World War II by running a factory that made fan belts for fighter planes. And you identify a pivotal moment in his childhood when Miyazaki was four and an air raid destroyed his neighborhood. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, that is an extraordinary moment because you see him revisiting it in so many ways in his films. It would be a pivotal moment for anyone, but he's an artist, so he could do more with it. He wakes up in the morning. It's, I believe it's March 1945. This is the time of the huge, massive air raids from Americans on the mainland Japan, which had been sort of coming and coming for a while, but now they were enormous numbers of planes coming in. And this was Tokyo, or near Tokyo. And this was Tokyo at one point, in one night, 100,000 people were killed from the bombings. This was huge civilian airstrikes. And Miyazaki and his family were rather well off. And they had enough money to have a van of some kind and gas, which would be very unusual in the last days of the war for a private family to have. And so he wakes up to see his whole room all pink and red, like it was dawn or sunset, but actually it's the fires on the streets all around him. And he and his family, his uncle and his father and mother, get into the van, and they're driving off through the streets that are on fire. And a neighbor comes and asks them, and this is Miyazaki's memory, to let her on with her baby. And the grown-ups sort of look at each other and say, "We really can't do this. We're sorry. We just don't have the room." This was very shocking to Miyazaki, and he says to himself, he ruminates on this for years and years and years. It's clearly kind of one of these big traumatic moments in his life. And he says, "You know, of course I understand. It was a war, there were the fires, and we had to get out, and our van really was, you know, totally full up. But," he says, "you know, I like to think that my brother and I, if we had, you know, been a little stronger, we would have said, 'No, come on, we'll manage somehow to let you on.'" And he likes to think that there are children out there in the world who will not accept what the grown-ups say about, "What can you do? We can't do anything." And will say, "No, we can do something. And we can let people, we can help other people escape these terrible circumstances." And throughout his work, you have these very strong, resilient, smart children who say, "No, I'm not going to accept what's awful going on here. I will try to change things. I will resist." And of course, this is also Miyazaki himself. But he dreams of these little kids as changing the world in a very positive way.
Now, in your book, you describe what is called Miyazaki world. What does that world look like, and why is it that way?
Wow. That's an interesting question. No one's ever asked me that. I thought of Miyazaki world because I kept calling Miyazaki a world builder. And of course, that immediately suggests imagery. And, you know, someone like, you say, Walt Disney, there's a definite Disney look and Disney style. That's also true of Miyazaki as well, that his world is incredibly beautiful. As you said, you have beauty and terror often combined in almost transcendently beautiful sequences and imagery. But more than imagery, he also has this overall kind of message that he's trying to give out in his Miyazaki world, that it's giving you other ways of living. It's saying, it's first of all, it's critical. It's basically critical of our own world and saying, do we have to live like this? There are almost no villains. This is something that American audiences find very, very difficult sometimes to process, because they keep wanting to see who's a bad guy, you know, who's a bad guy, who's a good guy, because the world of Miyazaki world is not a clear-cut place. It's not obvious who's good, who's bad. People are shaded. People are complex. So it's a world that is not at all, I would say, escapist. I'd say it's multifaceted and offering, as I say, different ways of being.
Now, one of the simple pleasures for me from his films in Miyazaki world is the way he depicts water. It makes me thirsty. It makes me want to swim. It's just beautiful how he does that. I'm thinking of Ponyo,
yes,
but also Spirited Away, when the baths,
yes,
area floods all around and the train skirts right across the top of the water. It's just gorgeous.
Wow, what a scene. What a scene.
Yeah.
Yes, water is very important. I actually think that sometimes in some of his movies, he's almost getting into sort of an awareness of Taoism, which is the ancient Chinese philosophy, a little bit related to Zen, of the fact that the world is made up of these elements, and there are four elements, earth, wind, and water, and fire. But water becomes really a very big deal in many of his scenes. You mentioned Ponyo. There's a sequence of waves coming in that is just viscerally exciting.
It must be a tsunami!
Turn the ship into the wave!
And you really feel like you're just being bombarded by them. And then the clear pools of Princess Mononoke, these deep, almost sacred, transcendently beautiful pools in the green forest. And I say Spirited Away with this very interesting final sequence of a train moving on water across. And it's very almost uncanny. And yet it has a kind of quiet beauty that, again, kind of draws you in. As I keep saying, he's such an immersive filmmaker that you're kind of on the train, being part of the train, but also being part of this watery landscape that unfolds all around you.
It's dreamy and peaceful.
Nice.
In a way that's not really easy to explain unless you see it.
Yes.
In the United States, how have his films been received, and what films have broken through?
It's been interesting. It's taken a long, long time. The big moment is when Disney and Studio Ghibli sign a contract in, I believe, 1996. Or maybe 1997, and Walt Disney will distribute Miyazaki's films. And that, of course, was very huge. And they selected as a film that they wanted to push a film called Princess Mononoke, which is an interesting choice. It's a really extraordinary film. I've mentioned that the water scenes are stunning. It's a very apocalyptic film. As I write in my book, I took a friend of mine to see it, and he kept nudging me and saying, "Who's a good guy? I can't tell which is a good guy, which is a bad guy." And Princess Mononoke does not allow you that kind of easy understanding. So the film did okay. And then you have Spirited Away. 2001, the movie was made, and I think a lot of people went into it, sort of helped this one, the marketing on this one. Ultimately, it received the Academy Award for Best Animated Movie, which is a big deal because it actually beat out, I think, two or maybe three Disney other contenders. So that was huge. And then you have Howl's Moving Castle was also very, really quite popular. I have many of my students come into my seminar because they just loved Howl's Moving Castle. They loved the characters. Many of my women students thought the howl was very cute. And again, the sort of the beautiful, beautiful graphics of the film really brought people in.
What do you think Hayao Miyazaki's legacy is?
Oh, wow. That's hard to say because I want him to keep, you know, making more films, of course, and he is busily working on a new film. I would say a commitment to ideals, for one thing. It sounds unusual for an animation director to say that. He keeps showing us these possibilities of what one can do, what might happen, what other kinds of worlds might we be able to inhabit. He refuses to allow despair. And yet, he is a filmmaker whose legacy will include visions of catastrophe, of apocalypse, of war, of darkness and trauma. At the same time, with these visions of darkness, he insists on showing some kind of heart of light that continues to glow in his movies. And I always quote this last scene in the manga version of Nausicaa of the Valley of the Wind, in which the heroine Nausicaa is arguing with a creature known as the Master of the Crypt, and the creature is trying to say to her, you know, life is light. And he's trying to make it kind of easy, kind of platitude. And she says, no, life is the light that shines in the darkness. And to me, that's his legacy. He doesn't pretend or minimize the darkness, but he insists that there is still a light that shines inside the darkness.
Well, Susan, it's been a delight to talk to you.
Well, I've enjoyed it too. It's been such fun. Thank you.
Susan Napier is the author of Miyazaki World, A Life in Art. She spoke with Beta Steve Gotcher. You can find out more about Miyazaki's world at wpr.org/beta.
Thom Yorke said to one of the musicians, imagine that you're in a car and you get into an accident and you get out of your car and the other person gets out of their car and you're raising your fist and you're just about to hit them. Now play like that.
Music critic Stephen Hyden tells us how Radiohead's 2000 album Kid A served as an overture for the 21st century. That's coming up in just a moment. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.